I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Biden signed an executive order early on in his administration, laying out an ambitious goal to reduce carbon emissions to net zero by the year 2050. That means weaning the country off fossil fuels, expanding renewables, investing in carbon capture to reduce the harmful effects of climate change, things like droughts and floods, warming ocean temperatures, rising seas, and more powerful storms. There is a real sense of urgency because 2020 was one of the hottest years on record in spite of the pandemic, which reduced economic activity. We asked Jesse Jenkins to join us. He's an energy systems engineering professor at Princeton University, and he's lead author of the Princeton Net Zero America Study, which outlines a series of pathways to get us to that 2050 goal. He joins us by Skype. And Jesse Jenkins, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. It's a pleasure to be here.
I have a very basic question to get our conversation started. What's the difference between zero emissions and net zero emissions?
Yeah, it's a great question. So zero emissions would mean that we'd have no direct emissions from, you know, tailpipes of vehicles or power plants or industrial facilities of any greenhouse gas emissions. That would include things in, like agricultural-related emissions of nitrous oxides and methane from oil and gas production as well. Net zero greenhouse gas emissions means that we may have some residual emissions from things that are hard to decarbonize, like jet fuel or those agricultural or related emissions, but that will balance out any human-caused greenhouse gas emissions by removing an equivalent quantity of greenhouse gases from the atmosphere every year and safely storing that carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gases. So we'd be at a net zero contribution to rising atmospheric concentrations of CO2 that are warming the planet.
We have 30 years. It's, you know, a little less than 30 years to get us to 2050. Can we do it? And are the challenges or even obstacles more political than they are technological?
We did find that the transition to net zero by 2050 is affordable and achievable with technologies that we basically know how to build today, things that have either been demonstrated at a pilot or scale or already commercially available. So that's the really good news. The challenge, though, is that it requires a wholesale transformation of how we make and use energy all across the country in just 30 years' time or 29 years now. And when it comes to infrastructure planning or technology development and commercialization, you know, 2050 is basically the day after tomorrow.
Right.
And so if we're not acting very seriously right now, that goal will kind of recede off the horizon and we won't be able to make it by 2050.
The culprit, I guess, is burning fossil fuels, correct? I mean, that's a thing that we have to get off of or certainly reduce.
Yeah, that's the primary contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. We would need to dramatically reduce our reliance on fossil fuels, starting with coal, which is the most potent, most carbon intensive of fossil fuels, and also one that we have the most readily available substitutes for, because most coal is used in power generation. And we have a lot of affordable, clean sources of electricity now, thanks to prior investments in, you know, wind and solar power and batteries and other technologies. So coal would be basically phased out of our energy system over the next decade in each of our pathways that we explored. And then oil and gas use would be reduced by between 55% and 100% by 2050. And so some of those cases continue to use fossil fuels where we depend on capturing the CO2 emissions at the point of combustion and storing it safely, a process known as carbon capture and storage, or that we would be drawing down negative emissions, taking CO2 out of the atmosphere to compensate for any direct emissions from fossil energy. So we may not need to drive fossil fuels to zero, but we do need to dramatically reduce them. And any emissions that remain have to be either captured or fully offset by negative emissions.
And I do want to get to electricity. How do you factor in natural gas, which has often been called this bridge fuel between coal and something else?
Yeah. I mean, in all of our pathways, natural gas continues to play a pretty important role over the next decade and even is retained to some degree in 2050 in many of the pathways. But if you think of it as a bridge, that bridge has to start arcing over and, you know, heading down towards the other side, right? You know, bridges don't go up forever.
No.
So that's where we're at now, which is that basically we would need to see natural gas use, you know, flatten in the next decade and begin to decline by around 2030 and really reduced significantly by 2050. It's a similar trajectory for oil use, which, you know, we continue to use in, you know, vehicles and other applications to some degree, but with growth in demand for vehicle use offset by improved efficiency of vehicles and also a switch to electric vehicles, which is really starting to gather steam.
Well, let's talk about the electrical grid or the electrification, I guess, of our economy. Looking into the future, is that our future? If we're going to get to this 2050 goal, is electricity how we're going to power our economy, our homes, and electricity that gets its power from what?
Yeah, electricity and clean electricity is really a linchpin in any of our strategies to decarbonize the overall economy or get to that net zero goal. And the electric power sector really faces two big challenges. The first is that we have to transition to clean sources of electricity, things like wind and solar power, maintaining our existing nuclear power plants, and maybe even expanding and, you know, deploying a new generation of nuclear reactors later in the 2030s and 2040s, or relying on other technologies like geothermal energy, clean hydrogen combustion, or use in fossil fuels. So there's a range of options there, but we have to drive down emissions in the electricity sector really faster than any other sector, and do so at the same time that we're expanding our use of electricity to power electric vehicles, to switch to heat pumps, you know, efficient heat pumps for heating our buildings and water heating in homes and in commercial buildings, and to produce hydrogen from electrolysis, which is a process that takes clean electricity and splits water into hydrogen and oxygen, and we can use that hydrogen as a clean fuel. And so electricity use grows by about 150% or more across the five pathways we looked at in the Net Zero America study. So more than doubling by 2050 at the same time that we have to drive those emissions in the power sector down basically to zero. So it's a big challenge and a centerpiece of all of these pathways.
And the obvious question is, do we have enough renewable technology to be able to power, you know, a grid that is so demanding of electricity? If you're looking at solar or wind, I realize we're kind of at the beginning of this stage, but can we meet that demand?
Yeah, you know, wind and solar have grown substantially over the last decade, thanks to proactive public policy that supported those technologies when they were, you know, expensive alternative energy sources. They're now really affordable and mainstream options that are being deployed at, you know, large scale today, and their growth is accelerating. So wind power has fallen in cost by about 70% in the last decade alone. So since the last time Congress considered, you know, serious climate legislation in 2009 and 2010, we've seen the cost of wind fall by 70%, and we've seen the cost of solar power fall by 90%. You know, so that means solar is 1/10 the cost as it was, you know, a decade ago. And so those technologies are really affordable and mature and ready to scale up. They supply about 11% of our electricity nationally now. That's more than we get from hydropower. And over the next decade, each of the pathways we modeled would deploy about 550 to 600 gigawatts of wind and solar. That's a growth rate of, or an average rate of about 60 gigawatts a year. And we deployed about 34 gigawatts last year. So we need to be picking up the pace every year, you know, kind of smashing records for the pace of deployment of wind and solar, and, you know, accelerating towards that goal of 600 gigawatts by 2030.
Does that mean wind farms, solar farms, or does that mean that people, you know, put panels on top of their apartment building or their house? I mean, in terms of how we get energy to where we live or where we work, how do we do that?
Yeah, as with many things, it's a little bit of everything. But we can rely more on distributed generation like solar, either on, you know, households or larger solar facilities that are more distributed around, you know, where we live. And that can reduce our need to expand the transmission system or build out, you know, big wind farms and solar farms. But the bulk of the total is likely to be utility scale, you know, quote unquote, wind farms and solar farms, which are these large facilities, you know, several hundred megawatt scale or tens of megawatt scale that are, you know, built out. And, you know, generally that requires an expansion of our transmission system as well to support that growth and to tap into the best wind and solar resources across the country. We have an abundance of wind and solar potential in this country. I mean, the United States is blessed with an enormous amount of renewable resource, you know, land area, we're better positioned than many other countries to reach this goal of net zero emissions. And so the challenge is figuring out, you know, where we want to build these facilities, what, you know, what community involvement is needed to figure out how to site those projects in ways that don't engender backlash and, you know, community opposition, and how to expand the transmission system to tap into this important U.S. natural resource.
You mentioned nuclear, and Bill has a comment in your conversation about other types of energy production. We need to talk about nuclear power, which is the only way that we can meet the economic demands of today. And Jesse, you mentioned nuclear. What role do you see it playing? And you even mentioned the fact that there might be newer forms of nuclear power that are different from what we have now.
Yeah, it's important, I think, to take both of those different propositions separately, our existing fleet and the potential for new nuclear. You know, nuclear power today supplies about a fifth of our electricity, so about double what we get from wind and solar power. It's a substantial contributor and what I think of as basically a foundation for building on. And, you know, if that foundation crumbles and we have to replace existing nuclear power plants with new, you know, basically replace existing carbon-free generation with new carbon-free generation, every megawatt hour we do, you know, we add of wind or solar that replaces nuclear is a megawatt hour that could have gone to replacing polluting fossil fuel power plants. And that's a big opportunity cost. If we're trying to make rapid progress to meet these goals of, you know, cutting emissions in half by 2030 and getting to net zero by 2050, we really have to be focused on, you know, phasing out coal first, ramping down our reliance on natural gas second, and then if we, you know, complete that goal, retiring and replacing existing nuclear plants at the end of their lifetime. The question of new nuclear is a more open and uncertain one. There really has been a, you know, terrible track record in the last decade of building new nuclear power plants at the very large gigawatt scale. That's enough to power like a million households, you know, so sort of city scale generation. And there were an attempt to build four new reactors in South Carolina and Georgia in the last decade that have really gone awry with, you know, massive cost overruns and delays that drove one utility in South Carolina into bankruptcy, drove Westinghouse, the producer of those reactors, into bankruptcy. And so it's very unlikely we will see new large, you know, gigawatt scale reactors built in the, you know, the vein of the power plants built in the 1970s through 90s. But there's a new generation of reactors that are working their way through the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's, you know, extensive licensing process that are much smaller. They're called small modular reactors, and they're on the sort of 60 to 300 megawatt scale, so a fraction of the size of prior power plants. And the hope is that they can be built in a more factory setting. They can be built faster and with less construction risk. And in sequence, where we learn from building, you know, the same crews can build the same, you know, 12 reactors or six reactors at the same site and learn through that sort of serial production. You know, there's a potential there, and we won't really know until those reactors hit the market, which won't happen until the end of this decade, in the late 2020s.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. I want to ask you about NIMBY, none of my backyard, when it relates to some of these ideas. That's Jesse Jenkins. And again, he's an energy systems engineering professor at Princeton University, lead author of the Princeton Net Zero America study, outlining a series of ways to get to this 2050 goal of net zero emissions. And we want to hear from you, as always, on Radio Times. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always pick up the phone. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow. And just to recap here, President Biden has set a climate goal of net zero emissions by the year 2050. Our guest, Princeton professor Jesse Jenkins, part of the Net Zero America Project, is laying out a variety of different pathways to get us to net zero emissions. And later on in the show, we'll be talking about the various ways the warming planet is actually altering our National Park Service and what the Park Service is doing in response. Well, let me ask you about the NIMBY. You know, you mentioned the fact of these sort of small nuclear power plants, or even wind farms, or wind farms that are out in the ocean. There has been pushback against that. How do we deal with that?
Yeah, it's a significant challenge. One of the several big challenges that we identify as the potential to derail or delay the transition to net zero, even though it's an affordable or feasible transition, there's a lot of challenges to overcome. And generating, social acceptance and community buy-in for the deployment of lots of new energy infrastructure is one of the central challenges. Yeah. I think of it in some ways as, we have to start to approach this challenge as a new kind of nation building moment that's similar to, the era in the New Deal or the post-war era when we built out our modern 20th century infrastructure in this country. We now have a similar challenge to rebuild our energy infrastructure for the 21st century to, dramatically reduce air pollution impacts from fossil energy use that could save hundreds of thousands of lives between now and 2050, we estimate between 200 and 300,000 avoided deaths from air pollution if we make this transition, and to avoid the threat of climate change. And so if we're going to do that, we have to get back into a kind of infrastructure building mode. There's been a lot of talk in Washington about an infrastructure investment, and so it's a good time for that. Energy really needs to be at the center of that infrastructure push. And so, that means new conversations with communities about how we're, going to build out that infrastructure. And I think that is going to require a shift from, the way things that have been progressing historically, which is that individual kind of project developers approach a project, and then communities and government agencies basically have a long process where they tell you all the reasons you can't do that. We need to approach it at more of a programmatic or kind of mission-driven scale, at more of a national scale, to say, look, we need to build 600 gigawatts of wind and solar. We need to expand our transmission system by half. We need to build a national CO2 transportation and storage system to capture carbon emissions. Where do we want to do that? And how are we going to do that at scale? And what communities would like to host those sorts of facilities? Because there are real tangible benefits too. Employment and tax base and royalty payments for landowners, all of those accrue where we build this infrastructure as well. And so we have to kind of balance the benefits and costs and find communities that want to support this infrastructure at scale.
I do want to get to carbon capture. Let me read a comment from David. Raising animals for food accounts for 51% of human-generated climate breakdown gases. Many of us who study and advocate on climate are demoralized by the persistent canard that mainly focuses on fossil fuels, coming nowhere addressing the actual problem. The actual problem from David's perspective is the fact that we eat animals.
Well, as in so many things, there are multiple contributors and we have to tackle many things at once. In our study, we explicitly did not include any large scale lifestyle changes like, shifting off of meat consumption or, substantial changes in vehicle travel patterns and things like that. Those are all really powerful levers to potentially reduce greenhouse gas emissions as well. I think it's going to be ones that are very challenging to do from a kind of sacrifice perspective. I think it's going to be, if we can make meat substitutes, whether those are vegetarian or, synthetic lab-grown meat or other approaches, just better, affordable, more tasty substitutes and help reduce meat consumption or shift to less greenhouse gas intensive forms of meat like poultry, then we could start to see those emissions fall, just as we could, build more walkable, livable, enjoyable cities and towns that could help reduce vehicle travel. So all of that would help. It would make the scale of the infrastructure build out that we identify in the Net Zero America study easier and smaller. But it isn't strictly necessary. We do find these pathways are feasible with a kind of business as usual level of meat consumption, of vehicle miles, building square footage, et cetera. So that's another set of levers that we have at our disposal. And, as usual, we should be pulling on as many levers as we can to make progress on such a big challenge.
Well, one of those levers, as you describe it, is carbon capture technology. There are even, biomass crops that can be planted. Help us understand that part of getting to net zero.
Yeah, we actually found that carbon capture and either storing or using the captured CO2 was a central pillar in all five of the pathways that we looked at. That includes a pathway that was 100% renewable energy supply. And the reason carbon capture shows up in that scenario, even without any use of fossil fuels, is that we do need some sort of hydrocarbon fuels. We need liquid and gaseous fuels that are energy dense and substitute for our fossil fuels today, for things like jet fuel or high temperature industrial processes that really just need that kind of hydrocarbon fuel. And so we can either keep using fossil energy in those contexts and then capture the CO2 emissions, or we can there are three options. That's the first option. The second is we can keep using those fossil energy sources and then use biomass that we grow either as, you know, dedicated energy crops or as agricultural or forestry residues. And we can turn that biomass into hydrogen that we can use as a clean fuel and carbon dioxide that we can capture and store. And since that carbon was absorbed from the atmosphere when the plants grew, we're basically removing that CO2 from the atmosphere. And that can be a form of negative emissions that offsets some of the fossil related emissions. And the third option is to actually use that bioenergy directly to produce synthetic fuels. And so that's what happens in the 100% renewable case is we use the biomass, CO2 captured from that biomass and hydrogen produced from other sources, and we make synthetic hydrocarbons. We take the hydrogen and the carbon and we put them together with more energy and use that to make synthetic fuels. So all three of those are options. They all have, you know, trade-offs associated with them, and we need to sort of balance all three of those kind of legs of the stool to deal with all of the different energy sources that we don't electrify. So, you know, we're going to electrify a lot of things, but not everything. And so the remaining fuel use for, you know, pipeline gas or liquid fuels like diesel or jet fuel, we're going to have to find a substitute in that. You know, those are our three options, basically.
Here's a comment from Susan, Sue, who says, can you acknowledge that what to do with nuclear waste is a big problem that will last for hundreds, if not thousands of years?
Yeah, of course, it is an ongoing problem. In my view, after studying this issue for quite a long time, nuclear waste is a much more solvable problem than global climate change and on a much more contained scale. There's something like 60 to 65,000 tons of high-level nuclear waste in the U.S. from all of the history of nuclear power generation. That might sound like a lot. You know, we think things in measured in tons are large, but sure. We consume a billion tons of coal each year. So we're talking about, 65,000 tons from all nuclear power over 30 or 40 years versus a billion tons of coal every year and all the associated pollution that goes along with that. So it is a challenge. It's one that we have technical solutions for. Other countries have made broader social progress on identifying long-term geologic storage opportunities or reprocessing that waste. And so it's mostly a political challenge, a similar kind of social, decision about where and how we want to manage that waste. But it is an order of magnitude easier challenge than trying to solve climate change. And so, in that sense, I think nuclear is an important contributor to the climate challenge. And we're going to have to figure out a long-term solution to nuclear waste as well.
That is Jesse Jenkins, and he is an energy systems engineering professor at Princeton University, lead author of the Princeton Net Zero America Study. And again, it provides a series of pathways to get the country to this goal of net zero emissions by the year 2050. That, of course, is some 30 years away. And again, you can join us. Any questions or comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. And you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Ray has a comment saying, reduced consumption from consumers is the main way to combat climate change. And let me just toss in, conservation and efficiency and sort of changing our profligate way of life here in the United States. Is that a factor?
Yeah, I mean, energy efficiency is one of the central pillars or building blocks of all of our pathways to decarbonization or net zero, as is electrification, which actually, does sort of double duty. It is much more efficient use of energy to power an electric motor than an internal combustion engine or a heat pump than a boiler to heat our buildings or our water. And so, switching to electric vehicles or heat pumps actually not only switches to a cleaner energy source from electricity, but also is a more efficient process. And so together, we actually see that those methods would reduce overall energy consumption in the United States, even as we expand our economy and our population over the next three decades. So, you know, those kinds of measures are important. And again, those lifestyle changes that I talked about, we, you know, didn't include them in these pathways, but they are other levers that would help get the job done. And so to the degree we can reduce overall consumption, we can, you know, live in more walkable, you know, bikeable, you know, carpoolable cities and commute patterns, and we can reduce our consumption of greenhouse gas intensive meat. All of those things help as well. There are, you know, multiple levers at our disposal, and really none of them is the way to do it, because we really need a you know, basket of solutions to get this big challenge solved.
Well, this is a more political question, but you mentioned infrastructure. And as we know, the Biden administration's infrastructure bill is, I'm not going to say dead, but certainly there's been no progress negotiating with Republicans on this issue. And that is our political system. And I hear what you're saying, Jesse, in terms of what we need to do. My question is really, how do we have the political system to make this happen? Or does this happen more on an individual level or a state level or an urban government level?
I would I don't want to mean to be dire about this, but I would say that, you know, there are efforts that individuals and communities and states can make. And there have been a lot of leaders, in, you know, at those levels, the individual, community and state level, that have been keeping, you know, progress moving. But we can't reach net zero greenhouse gas emissions without a national scale effort. And only the federal government can do that. And so we really do need Congress to enact legislation in a timely and robust manner. That can get us on this track to net zero over the next decade. You know, again, 2050 might sound like a long way off to some of us, you know, 30, 29 years from now. Sure. But again, from an infrastructure perspective, and given the wholesale transformation we need to achieve, that has to begin, you know, yesterday, ideally, but if not yesterday, then today. And so we need congressional action. You know, the proposal from the Biden administration, the American Jobs Plan, really did center investments in clean energy infrastructure and manufacturing as a big piece of that overall multi-trillion dollar plan. I think if you total all of the measures up, it's on the order of $1 trillion of public investment over the next 8 years. You know, that is roughly the right scale and scope that we need. Our study estimated that over the next decade, we need about $2.5 trillion of additional capital investment in clean energy and in efficient infrastructure. That relative to a current, you know, frozen policy kind of scenario where we don't have any additional policy. And so that's the policymakers' to-do list. They have to find a way to get through the politics and to enact legislation that can induce that $2.5 trillion. You don't have to spend every cent as the government, you know, but you need to either through regulations, direct procurement or spending or tax policy, incentivize that scale of investment from the private sector and the public sector combined. The politics are hard, but I do think the economic opportunity is substantial. We find that a transition like this would create 500,000 to 1 million net new jobs in energy supply sectors, mostly wind, solar, and transmission expansion over the next decade. And those would be really broadly distributed across the country. So there's a big engine of economic, you know, opportunity and job creation. And in the long run, there's, you know, big investments in rural communities for bioenergy and bio conversion to hydrogen or fuels. You know, so there hopefully, you know, is a bipartisan path. And if not, spending bills, you know, can be passed on a majority basis via the budget reconciliation process. And I know that's an option that that Democrats are considering as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's all very fraught, at least politically speaking. Let me read a comment from Kate. She's saying, why are other experts saying that in 15 years this planet will be unlivable? It's scaring me to death that people are so complacent. Why are we getting mixed messages?
Yeah, that's not really a credible scientific position, as I understand it, that, you know, the planet will be unlivable in 15 years. There's been some mixed messaging about the, you know, sort of points of no return or timelines at which we have to, you know, to get greenhouse gas emissions under control. And a lot of that has been, I think, confusing to the public, has made it through, you know, in various channels and in a confusing and somewhat you know, depressing or exasperating way. Well, you know, what the science has made clear is that you know, we're already about 1 degree of Celsius of global warming. And so the impacts that we're seeing now are from that kind of 1 degree level. And it doesn't sound like a lot, but it's already having big impacts all over the country, whether it's the, you know, wildfires that are more frequent and stronger in the West, or, you know, flooding and hurricanes along the coast. Every tenth of a degree matters. That's what the science makes clear. And so we need to be doing everything we can to bend that curve of greenhouse gas emissions globally downward. And the U.S. has the technological means and the wealth and arguably a moral responsibility, given our historic contribution to greenhouse gas emissions, to lead that transition. And if we do that and we bend that curve down, again, every tenth of a degree matters. There's no reason to give up here. There are not, you know, dire thresholds that we see as, you know, being nearby. There are just worse and worse outcomes the higher the temperatures get. And so we need to be driving those emissions and temperatures down as much as possible, as rapidly as possible.
A couple more minutes and a couple more questions. Here's one from William. He says, the one thing that will actually solve the problem is population control. What do you think about that?
I love all these, the questions all framed as the one thing that will solve
the problem. Of course,
right. I mean, again, that is a thing.
Let's dispel that rumor right now, yes.
You know, all of these things are potential levers at our disposal. Population control is an unlikely measure. I mean, you've seen how that worked in China, where now they're facing a real demographic problem of not enough children to support their, you know, their population and their economy. I think what we see globally is that when we you know, drive economic development and opportunity, when we empower women in particular in emerging economies and elsewhere, that population rates naturally fall. And in much of the world, we have, you know, including here in the United States, if you take out immigration, we are seeing, you know, birth rates that are below the replacement rate. And so, you know, over this next 30 years, we may see a really important demographic transition globally as well, which is that we'll start to see global population growth stop and the global population stabilize and even potentially start to decline in the later half of the century. You know, so this is a really the kind of crux moment for society to kind of get through this big demographic shift, this big transition of our energy infrastructure. And if we can manage it, we can build a much more sustainable, healthy and prosperous society for the long term.
And Jesse, about a minute here, President Biden is on his way to Europe. And this apparently will be an issue of discussion. You've been focusing on the United States, but in order to meet this overall goal, this has to be a global effort, doesn't it?
That's right. And global diplomacy and leadership are a really key aspect of that. The European Union has made similar commitments to a net zero goal, as have a number of other countries globally. Even China actually recently surprised many observers by contributing by committing to reach net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2060 after peaking global emissions, their emissions before 2030. So we're, again, in this sort of crux moment where much of the world is throwing themselves at this challenge. One of the big challenges actually was highlighted by a report from the International Energy Agency today is that we need to do more to make clean, cheap technologies available for and financing available for infrastructure investment in emerging economies, you know, rapidly developing economies, so that they can rely on cleaner sources of energy infrastructure to power their economic growth rather than build out a large fossil powered infrastructure. So there's lots of challenges at the global level. I think that where the U.S. can contribute the most is by using our purchasing power and our public investment and our technological ingenuity to make clean energy cheap for the world. In conjunction with our partners internationally. And, and if we do that, we can achieve this goal.
Well, I hope you're right. Jesse Jenkins, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Sure.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Our national park system is truly one of the country's most precious national treasures, and it's under threat because of climate change. Global warming has led to droughts and fires that have wreaked havoc on a number of parks out west. The warming temperatures are changing park ecosystems, affecting plants and wildlife. The Park Service, whose job it is to protect and preserve the parks for our enjoyment, has some new guidelines about how to manage the changing environment. And joining us is Patty Glick. She is Senior Scientist for Climate Adaptation at the National Wildlife Federation, lead author of that report titled Planning for a Changing Climate for the National Park Service. And Patty Glick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
You're very welcome. And let me make sure our listeners can join us as well. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us 1-888-477-9499. Patty, broadly speaking, what has been the impact of climate change on our national park system?
Well, you know, I mean, I think perhaps most notably, climate change is bringing challenges for parks whose namesake features are at risk. For example, scientists project that Glacier National Park in Montana may no longer have any glaciers within just a few decades. Wow. And at Joshua Tree National Park in California, they're seeing hotter and drier conditions, which are actually killing off that namesake species. And it kind of begs the question, you know, what does that mean for parks' legacy? You know, we've even joked a little bit about whether we need to start calling Joshua Tree National Park the park formerly known as Joshua Tree.
Oh, gosh. Well, I remember as a kid going to Glacier National Park and then taking my kid, several decades later, and how different that glacier was.
Very much so. In fact, you know, from some visitor centers at parks across the West, you may no longer be able to even see the glaciers that they were built there to help the public observe. So it is, you know, definitely something that is happening before our eyes. And, you know, of course, as somebody who works for the National Wildlife Federation, you know, the effects of climate change on the many species of fish and wildlife that rely on our national parks are quite concerning. I think one species that's often noted as a poster child for climate change is the American pika, which is a small and actually quite adorable animal that lives in high elevation areas of the West, such as at Rocky Mountain National Park in Colorado. And pikas are very sensitive to high temperatures, and as conditions across the region continue to warm, they're being forced farther and farther up the mountain to escape the heat. And you know, in some places, there's worry that they may disappear altogether, as there is really only so high they can go.
Let me put something else, just the numbers of fires that we saw more out west than here on the East Coast, which is hasn't sort of faced those drought problems that they're having out west. But I'm thinking about the forest fires, and there are sometimes naturally occurring fires that seem to be good for parks and for forests. But this seems at a whole other level.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, they're certainly in the Park Service, for one, has long recognized the importance of natural disturbances. Many of the ecosystems across the country, even some in the East, have, you know, evolved to rely on a certain amount of wildfire. But the fires that we're seeing now are fueled by a number of challenges, not the least of which is, you know, more extreme drought and higher temperatures from climate change. And you know, the risks are extreme, and it's affecting not only the natural systems in parks, but it's also placing visitors at risk. And you know, but I think it's certainly going to require for example, updated evacuation plans, as well as potentially the need for temporary closures to do things like prescribed burns. But, you know, of course, risks from climate change are occurring to visitors in other places. I think about a lot of the urban parks, like those around the Philadelphia area, sure, where there's a big concern about extreme heat. And in fact, from what I'm hearing, many of you in the Northeast are already gearing up for a record-breaking, heat event this weekend. And so parks are grappling with a lot of changes, you know, across the wide range of areas that they manage, from, you know, their facilities to wildlife and natural resources to, the many cultural and historic features that they embody, and then as well to visitor experiences.
So how is this changing, I guess, the goal, the work, the mission of the National Park Service?
Well, you know, I mean, the Park Service certainly for most of the past century has, you know, managed for, certain historical conditions, hopefully protecting many of those, and as part of their mission in, basically forever. You know, they use the term into perpetuity. But, you know, I think that there is, you know, this growing recognition just with a lot of the changes that they're already experiencing that, you know, the agency is going to need to find ways to address the risks in just about all aspects of its planning and management. You know, and unfortunately, the there's a growing recognition that under rapid climate change, efforts to protect or restore park resources based on historical benchmarks, or frankly, even to maintain some current conditions, is becoming increasingly untenable. And, you know, the agency has come to realize that as much as we hope to be able to resist the impacts of climate change, which is certainly something that many parks are trying to do, increasingly we're going to need to probably accept some changes or, you know, where possible, to facilitate or direct changes that will still support many of the things that people know and love about our national parks, even if they look a little different from snapshots of the past.
Does that mean closing parks cordoning off parts of parks in order to protect them from us?
Well, certainly, perhaps. I mean, so, you know, I gave the example of the American Pika. One of the things that parks are looking at is trying to identify areas that they call refugia. So areas that may, for example, on northern facing slopes, that may still stay cool even as the broader temperatures warm. And if they, you know, they're able to locate those places and the animals are able to persist in those places, perhaps strategies such as keeping visitors away from those so they don't disturb them might be warranted. And then, you know, I certainly also mentioned, you know, the risks to visitors. You know, I do think that parks, it's certainly here in the West where we do face these growing threats from significant wildfires, you know, they're going to have to be monitored those conditions very carefully so that not only people are not in harm's way, but we also reduce the risks that people might ignite some of those fires.
Sure. Campfires and things like that. I mean, is there a problem? Exactly. Is there a problem of us sort of loving our parks to death, or are we talking more about just what climate change is doing to the parks?
Well, it's a combination. You know, climate change is often considered a threat multiplier. So parks have grappled with a number of other challenges, things like expansion of exotic invasive species. And what we're seeing with changing climatic conditions is some of those species are actually able to, you know, take advantage of those conditions. Now, they tend to be more generalist than some of our native species.
And take over, essentially.
Because, and take over, exactly.
Right. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That is Patty Glick, and she's Senior Scientist for Climate Adaptation. That's at the National Wildlife Federation. And we're talking about a report she's the lead author of called Planning for a Changing Climate for the National Park Service. And the Park Service is dealing with climate change and trying to figure out how to protect and preserve the park, the flora and the fauna, the wildlife, to preserve the parks, but also allow us to come and go in healthy, safe ways for our own enjoyment. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Patty, are there efforts to actually relocate certain wildlife, certain animals, to get them to a more hospitable environment?
There are. So, you know, one thing I think is important to recognize is that, you know, climate adaptation certainly is an evolution in the way the Park Service is managing its resources. You know, in some areas, it's going to require innovation and experimentation. You know, for example, I mean, there has been some disagreement among some ecosystem restoration experts about this idea of so-called managed relocation of species, which entails, actively moving a species to areas where it didn't historically exist, but where it may be able to persist under changing climatic conditions. You know, for some people, this violates the fundamental tenets of ecological restoration, including an emphasis on maintaining native species within their historical ranges. But to others, it provides what very well may be the best hope of avoiding extinction, as long as the risks of any potential downsides of that action are effectively measured. And in fact, managers are already doing this at Glacier National Park, where they have moved native bull trout to higher elevation lakes that are expected to remain cool as temperatures there continue to rise.
So it's obviously something to keep an eye on, whether that adaptation can really occur, I guess, in real time.
Well, and that's true, and it's interesting too, because it's forcing parks to think beyond their own borders. There has been a lot of work on the plants and animals don't necessarily know where the edge of a park ends and another piece of land begins, or water, if you will. And so a lot of parks are starting to increase collaboration with neighboring communities in order to try to find ways to enhance the connectivity of those lands and waters and help facilitate the natural movement of some of these species as they track changing climatic conditions.
I'm thinking of sea level rise, which is something that is measurable, for instance, along the New Jersey shore. I mean, that's one of the more obvious effects of climate change. How are we seeing parks respond to that?
Well, so certainly sea level rise is probably one of the most direct impacts from climate change, and if not the most certain. And, it's absolutely having an impact on coastal parks across the country. It's interesting. I think one of the things that is particularly important about the Park Service's adaptation work is that the agency actually acknowledges inherent uncertainties of changing climate, but also the potential for surprises. Yeah. And given this, park planners and managers have been encouraged to consider multiple plausible future conditions that help them manage, identify strategies that may be robust to whatever changes occur. And I think on that regard, in your region, I think Hurricane Sandy was a real wake-up call for the agency.
We're still recovering from Hurricane Sandy. We haven't pulled all the pieces together after that.
I think it was something that really has made them realize that it's important to think not just about, the best case scenarios or the worst case scenarios, but all of the above. You know, even just months before the hurricane hit, managers at Gateway National Recreation Area in New Jersey, they looked at the vulnerability of many of their historic resources to potential storms and to sea level rise. And at the time, they looked at what they thought would be the worst case scenario, but, Hurricane Sandy, basically blew those assumptions out of the water. And managers there have since decided actually to refocus some of their restoration and protection efforts towards structures and areas that are considered less vulnerable, just because the challenge of those risks are so great.
Does this then mean a new approach to conservation from the National Park Service to think differently about its stewardship for the land?
Well, I think it's certainly an evolution of their management. From a natural resource perspective, I think that the Park Service recognizes that natural systems are dynamic, and to a certain extent, there is potential for adaptive capacity of those systems. Again, working with nature to help species, find ways to move across the landscape. I do think that the challenge is Particularly great, though, when you start thinking about, you know, cultural resources and historic resources that don't have an inherent adaptive capacity that the agency can help foster. And, you know, and I think there, unfortunately, some of the decisions are going to be a little bit more binary. You know, you protect these resources as long as you can. And then, unfortunately, at some point, there may be the need to accept their loss.
Well, we have to leave it there. Patty Glick, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
You are so welcome.
And she is Senior Scientist for Climate Adaptation at the National Wildlife Federation, and again, lead author of a report for the National Park Service Planning for a Changing Climate. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including how to sign up for our newsletter. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, Kelsey Hansen, and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.